There we go. Okay, Mike, you were here 2 years ago. How have you been?
All right. Lost a bit of weight. You know, bit of walking, bit of dancing. Nice.
Yeah. And you've been doing the Doctor Who tour, the world tour.
It does seem to be. I've been drawing the Doctor Who comic strip off and on for the last 10 years, since the show came back on TV.
Yeah.
Hello.
But it's only in the last couple of years that the rest of Europe seems to have noticed the show exists. And my God, you've noticed the show exists. It was phenomenal. I was in Norway last weekend at the Raptors Festival, and all these people dressed as various doctors or companions kept coming up and talking to me, and all saying, "Oh, you draw Doctor Who?" I go, "Well, I've always drawn Doctor Who." But it's amazing how the show's taken off. I mean, it started 50 years ago in Britain, so I grew up with the show. It was always there, apart from the 16-year period where they took it off the air. But it was always part of British culture. Doctor Who and the Daleks are as British as a cup of tea.
So what has it been like for you these past few years? Because you've been doing both the Doctor Who comic book, but you've also been storyboarding.
That's only this season.
That's just this season.
Yeah, I've started storyboarding for a TV show. So if you watch from episode 9 onwards, my name should be in the credits, because I know what's happening.
Any spoilers?
It's got a big blue box in it.
That's what you said 5 months ago as well.
That's all I can tell you. Yeah. I have to sign it. When you go to the BBC, the reception of the BBC, there's a security desk, and next to the security desk is a Dalek. It's the most bizarre and unreal thing you've ever seen. So these guys in uniform going, "You can't come through, sir." And a Dalek. Think, okay, I'm going to listen to you. But yeah, you have to sign so many bits of paper before they let you in the building. It's incredible.
Is that every time? Or?
First time I went there, they said, "Who are you here to see?" I said, "Oh, Doctor Who office, I'm supposed to be in some storyboarding." And they went, "All right, okay. Fill in this form. Now you've got to wait here. There's the electronic doors there. You can't go through them. Some of you have to come down from upstairs. They'll take you through the building to the doctor's offices, and then at the end of it, they'll escort you back down again. And you'll have to hand your pass back in, you know, the photographic pass, hand that back in." And I was like, "Oh, okay. Kept looking at the Dalek. And so this happened, I was right there, and guy Adrian came down and said, "Oh, you're Mike, I'll come up to the offices." Went up to the offices, had my meeting with the director for the first episode I was working on, which is actually the first episode of it was episode 9. So that all went well, and he led me back down, and I handed my pass over. And over the course of the next 2 weeks, I was going in and out. The fourth time I went there, they said to me, "Oh, we can't give you a pass, the machine's broken. Hang on, somebody come down for you." The fifth time I was there, I got to the desk and went, "Well, you know the way, don't you? Just go." "How about the pass?" "Oh, God, no."
"Oh, they know you now."
"Yeah, you go, well, oh. Yeah, hello, Mike," they said. I thought, okay, I'm part of the team.
So, how long have you guys been watching Doctor Who? How many years? Was it the first with Chris Eccleston? Was it David Tennant?
Tom Baker.
Okay, way back. When you're following a show for that long, and obviously you've been following it for that long, what's it been like for you working on it?
Oh, I'm 7 years old. I'm getting to play with the toys. The next story in Doctor Magazine, I'm writing as well as drawing, so I'm getting to put words in Peter Capaldi and Jimmy Coleman's mouths, which is just brilliant. I haven't worked out the full plot, but there's several scenes which I know line for line now, and I can, in my head, I can see them saying the lines, which is great.
So you're really enjoying yourself, aren't you?
No.
How would you?
It's just a job.
Yeah. Well, anybody who's seen Mike's page on Facebook will have seen his workspace, and it's got everything, just so you know.
One or two toys.
Yeah.
Do you know the great thing about being a comic book artist? Toys are tax deductible.
It's reference.
Yeah, it's all reference.
Okay.
I have, because I used to draw the Star Trek TV, Star Trek comic strip, so I had to go out and buy phasers and Enterprises all sorts of bits and pieces, and I just put them on a tax return, saying, claim for that. My accountant was like, "Really?" I go, "Well, I wouldn't have bought it otherwise."
Oh, so you don't play with it? Oh, no. But if you were to try and describe which doctor have you enjoyed the most, either working on or just watching?
Do you know what? I think Matt Smith. Actually, Matt Smith is brilliant. Right from the off, he just nailed the character, ran with it, brilliant. The one I found the hardest to draw was actually David Tennant, because he's too pretty. Eccleston, big ears. Matt Smith, big chin. And now we've got Capaldi, eyebrows. Finding it took me a while to sort of nail down my Tennant, so I felt I could sketch him. The guy that I grew up with, my first doctor as it were, the one I really watched was John Pertwee. And IDW that had the Doctor Who license for American publishing until the end of the year, end last year, got in touch with me because they were going to do this story which is going to feature all the doctors. And each issue was going to be a different doctor and each issue was going to have a different artist. And they said, well, look, you know, as I was the only artist that ever drew Eccleston, because he was only here for one season, they said, well, we'd really like you to do Eccleston. Oh, I said, that's great, thanks very much. Who's drawing John Pertwee? And they went, oh, we think we've got something for John Pertwee. Okay, so you want to draw Eccleston. I could draw John Pertwee as well. And they went, oh, no. And it went on for a while. I didn't hear from them. I thought, oh, I've annoyed them. And I got this email through saying, would you like to draw John Pertwee? So I got to draw the John Pertwee episode. So that was great for me. It was this whole thing about being a kid, getting to play with the toys, getting to draw the Doctor, getting to draw Bessie the car, getting to draw Sarah Jane Smith, getting to draw the Brigadier. For me, that was just wonderful. I suspect, even though I'm 53 years old, I still haven't grown up. There might be something to that. It's fun.
It should be. You've got the world as your playground. You've got every time period. You've got any place you want to go in the universe.
Well, yeah, one of the things that the philosophy of the Doctor Who comic strip is whatever Cardiff can't afford.
Everything.
So when you look at the TV show, we can afford to this. This is what I found working on the TV show, actually, is that they get them to storyboard something and they go, oh, okay, yeah, we know we can't afford that now, so we'll rewrite the scene. Because there's nothing worse than sort of deciding to do something and then finding you can't do it. But in the comic, we can do anything. We can have, you know, vast alien cities populated by thousands of aliens. No, they can't do that on telly. We can have giant robots crushing through vast alien cities populated by thousands of people. And they can't afford to do that. So our scope is immense. And that's brilliant. We do big, proper space opera stuff. So that's all the stuff I grew up enjoying. So it's good fun. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Do we have questions? We have a question.
Yeah. Two questions, actually, if that's okay.
Well, it depends.
The first one is if you could talk a bit about the process of coming up with an idea for a story for something like Doctor Who, where the universe is already established, so you don't have complete freedom. You have to like fit your idea into a frame that's already there.
Yeah.
And the second one, if you have, you could offer some advice on. Getting to write for Doctor Who comics, for instance, if one would be a comic book writer and want to try and write Doctor Who stuff?
The thing with writing is it's quite sewn up. The reason I'm writing the next story is that the current writer, who's also the editor, has decided he wants to take a break, but he's actually given me the outline for the story, so I'm actually working to his brief on it. So he said, I want this and the story, go and write it. So I'm going to do that. The stories written in the past, I've just done off the top of my head. I've come up with ideas, and then we've bounced them backwards and forwards. Oh, are we coming to the front?
We can't hear.
Sorry.
Is this on?
It's on. You're just not close enough.
I'm not close enough. How's that?
That's much better.
Can you hear me now at the back? Is there a back? It's just intimidating.
Could you give an example of how the story started out and then how you developed it?
Okay, well, the story that I did for the David Tennant Doctor was called The Futurists. And it was because I'd read about and got obsessed with the Italian Futurist movement. And I love the idea that there's this whole philosophy about creating a perfect world, throwing out the old world and rebuilding it. I thought, that's actually a really nice hook for a science fiction story. And I like the idea of everything being regulated. But there wasn't enough of it there. There wasn't quite enough of a story there. And at the studio where I'm based, an animation company, we had a writer that came to work at the studio for she ended up being there for about a year, who's an Italian animation and comic writer called Teo Rossi. And Teo was doing writing for some of the kids' animation shows that I do storyboards for. And I was talking to her about the futurists. And she's from Milan. So we were talking about, you know, what it was like in Milan, and I thought, okay, well, now I've got that as a starting point for my story. So we got Milan in the 1920s, because that was a really good period to set it in. So the story started evolving on that thing. And it still didn't have quite enough for me. And I thought, okay, well, you've got Italy, so when you think of Italy and history, you think of the Roman Empire. I live in Cardiff, where coincidentally Doctor Who's filmed. And there was a big Roman garrison based outside Cardiff in a place called Caerleon. And I thought, okay, well, that's quite a nice thing to sort of link it to. So maybe I'll do something with the Welsh occupation, the Roman occupation of Wales. And I sort of came up with this idea, and I thought, oh, I can link those two things together. And while I was working this out, I went to stay with my cousin who lives in Carlisle, up on the Scottish borders. And I went down into where Hadrian's Wall is, because that's not far from where she lives. And I was walking around Hadrian's Wall and found that there was actually a big public information thing about Hadrian's Wall. Now, at this point in my story, I was going to have a blonde-haired, blue-eyed son of a Roman governor who was going to be sort of influenced by what was going on. And I thought, well, that's quite a nice little device. I mean, it's a bit obvious, but what I found from reading up about Hadrian's Wall is that the guys that built Hadrian's Wall were actually stationed in Caerleon, not like 10 miles from where I lived, and most of the guys that worked on Hadrian's Wall weren't actually Europeans. They were Indians and Africans. They were part of the Roman auxiliary. So what used to happen was that when Rome went and invaded somewhere, they would attack an African village, wipe out most people, and find out who the best troops were, and then bring them into the Roman Empire, you know, into the Roman army. So you'd have your regular Roman soldiers, and then you'd have the auxiliary that fought alongside them. So I thought, actually, what would be more interesting if you got an African character as the central character in the story and have him as the one that he's been taken to the Roman Empire, and actually he's decided that Roman Empire is a really great idea. He's really up for it. They'd be around him going like, you know, really? And go, oh yeah, you know, it's order and it's organisation and it's roads and it's plumbing, all these great things. And so I then created this character that was a really sort of strong Roman who just didn't look like a Roman. And a neighbour of mine is a bouncer in nightclubs, a guy called Carson, who's this 6'4" Birmingham Jamaican guy. And Carson's never got into a fight in his life. If people come to a nightclub and start causing trouble, he just steps forward, takes his hat off and goes, hello. And suddenly they're quiet. So Carson was quite happy about posing for me, so there's a game of six pack. So I used him as the main character in the story. So I had these different elements. I had the Futurist movement, I had Roman occupied Wales, and then I needed something that linked the things up. And I had this stupid idea, I had it for years from watching Doctor Who, that whenever a Doctor Who story ends, nobody seems to be bothered by the fact that, I don't know, Big Ben's smashed, or, you know, vast tracts of London have been destroyed, or, you know, political figures have been killed. So what if there's actually, within the time space, there's a race whose job is basically to go around and clean up afterwards? So what happens is that, you know, they're not sentient, but they sort of go in and they smooth things out. And so I created these characters who, and that was their job. So all the way through history, what they've done is whenever a Time Lord, usually the Doctor, has gone in and messed up a situation, they sort of go in and like, and part of the thing is they remove film from cameras, or all the things just settle down and people sort of forget that things have happened. And the idea would be is that since the Time War, since the Time Lords have fallen, there's nothing to sort of keep them in reign anymore. So they've decided that the universe is a mess, and so they're going to tidy it up. And one of the first things they do is contact this guy in 1920s Milan, who is part of the Futurist movement, pick his brains and go, okay, this is fantastic. We're going to use you as our new way of organising these, because his whole thing is about removing the past, making everything nice and neat. So I then had that as the linchpin of the story. So you've got these characters, you've got the idealist futurist from the 1920s, you've got the idealist African soldier from the 4th century, and they end up swapping places in history. And I then decided what would be really nice is, what if, because I've never seen it done in a comic or never seen it done on TV, when history's changed, you know, you use it there as it's happening, but what if history had been changed 2,000 years before? And you're still where you thought you were. So in the first episode, 1920s Milan suddenly becomes this vast, almost alien city that's completely dead. Because what's happened is the Hadrian, which is what I call this race, had their way. They'd made everything equal and everything level, and humanity's wiped itself out because the Roman Empire got guns in the 3rd and 4th century, then got spaceship in the 7th century, and they've wiped out everything. They've just destroyed everything. So the Doctor and this character, who are based on Taya because she'd done so much research for me, and Carson, my neighbour, the doorman, and it was Rose at the time, are just standing there finding that there's nobody else alive in the Earth. And so they have to work out where the big event is, and they then go back to Roman-occupied Wales to try and sort things out. And I did this whole segment in the second part of the story where I had this Welsh resistance movement, which did exist at a certain point but then sort of petered out. And I quite liked that idea. The idea of, yes, these Romans are here. We will get rid of these Romans. We will deal with these Romans. Oh, do you know what? I fancy a pint. And, you know, and it also felt that you just had this little group who went and fought the Romans every so often, but they were just a nuisance rather than anything else. They didn't do very much. And it was only after I'd drawn it, only after it saw print, I realised I'd done a Welsh Asterix and Obelix. And it's just, I looked at it and thought, I've got a big guy with a moustache wearing checked trousers, and it's like, it's Obelix. But seriously, I had not noticed it when I was doing the whole thing. Nobody else had noticed it either, which is really funny. But yeah, so I did that thing. When I wrote the third part, I had the Welsh Obelix character going, these Romans are crazy, just to get, you know, reference the comic in there. So the story, as you can do, I've rambled here a bit, but came from it six different directions. It's just pulling bits together. I mean, the story I'm plotting at the moment for the next Doctor Who comic, I've got the brief that my editor's given me, but there's other things I want to do as well, and I want to pull things in from different directions and just make it interesting. I like stories where the second episode doesn't obviously follow on from the first episode. So you think, oh, I know where this is going, but then something completely bizarre happens, but then you as the writer have to work out what that bizarre thing is and why it ties together, otherwise it's a cheat. So at the moment, I've got a sequence worked out which actually I've completely dialogued in my head, but I've got to make it fit in the story. Jenna Coleman's brilliant to write dialogue for. I mean, I like to mention Matt Smith, but all the stuff she's done with Capaldi has been fantastic. Mm-hmm. She's really come alive as a character. Because it's almost 1940s Hollywood sort of screwball comedy banter they've got going. My favourite movie is His Girl Friday. Have you ever seen that? Okay, His Girl Friday is based on a play called The Front Page, which is about two reporters. And the original play is two guys. In His Girl Friday, they made one of the characters a woman. And so you've suddenly got this romantic tension between the two characters. And what I liked about it, and what I think I can see that Stephen Moffat's been doing with the relationship in Doctor Who at the moment, is they actually wrote 2.5 hours of dialogue, then made an hour and a half movie. So all the dialogue is like that all the way through, just snap, snap, snap. And if you look at the way the scenes with the Doctor and Clara are now, they really zip along. So the dialogue's compressed and everything's sharp and sassy. I like that sort of stuff. So I have rambled it. Anyway, I don't know if that helped you at all.
It's great. It's great.
Yeah. No,
very interesting.
Yeah. But other questions?
Hello.
Yeah, they're all very quiet. Aren't
they are.
They? Yeah.
You can talk to me.
Can you tell us the title of your episode? Or is it a secret story?
It's secret because the only title I can give, it gives away the entire I really, that always
can
be very
good. You can call it the Big Blue Box.
The Big Blue Box, it's a Big Blue Box. So.
On the TV show, are there writers that focus on the dialogue and then others, the plot is more coming in from various other people?
I think
the dialogue specialised in a few people.
Yeah, one of the episodes I worked on, episode 9. It's episode 9, actually. The dialogue is incredible. The bits I laughed out loud just reading it on the page. And what's great is if you can read it and you can see the actor saying those words, then the guy's got it. So it's written by a guy whose name is completely escaped, Jamie something, but he's also written episode 8 as well, which is the one set on the Orient Express. Do you know what that one's called? It's called Mummy on the Orient Express. which features a mummy on the Orient Express. But the dialogue is fantastic. And yeah, you're right, there are some writers that are really good at dialogue, some that are really good at action and plotting. I think the joy of Stephen Moffat's stuff is he can do both. And I suspect that some episodes do get rewritten by him just to punch up the dialogue a bit. So notice on the first couple of episodes, it's a writer and Stephen Moffat. So I think he might have gone in and sort of done a little polish on the work. So which happens on TV. I mean, on all the time things get done. I mean, one of the episodes I worked on, I had two completely different drafts of the episode. So certain things on storyboard, we had to go back in and go, well, that's great, but that's not happening anymore. So can you do this instead?
So do they change the script on you when you are doing the storyboarding a lot, or?
Bits change. Bits change because locations change, or actors' availability changes.
Or they can't do it in Cardiff.
Well, they can't do it in Cardiff, yeah.
You were telling me, I think it was last night, that you had figured out a way to create a Dalek army with a snap of a finger.
It's okay. With me this weekend, I had copies of the Dalek Project, a very nice graphic novel, 128 pages of Dalek-y goodness, or badness. but the writer, God bless him, thinks in terms of vast scope and vast scale. So he can say things to me like, 25 of this regiment of Daleks come from this direction, 150 of these different Daleks from this direction, and there's another 60 of these Daleks come from this direction. Go draw it now. And there's a certain point where you as an artist cry, because you really don't want to draw these Daleks. And it occurred to me that actually, if I drew lots of Daleks together like that, that they'd all look a bit different, and the whole thing about Daleks is they should look the same. So what I ended up doing with the big battle sequences is that in Photoshop there's a function where you can create brushes. So most people do this to create dust splatter or snowflakes. I created Daleks. So I did several Dalek drawings, which are all from different angles, which I knew I'd needed in the shots. And then what you do is that drawing in Photoshop, you do it as a single document. And then you click create brush. And what that means is when you come to draw the page, I sort of roughed it all out, scan the artwork into Photoshop, and they went click on that brush, and then Dalek, Dalek, Dalek. And there's up and down buttons that make the brush bigger or smaller as you're drawing. So if you want an army coming towards you, it's like bigger, 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 smaller, 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 smaller. And that way you had consistently all these Daleks that look the same in a line. Now, I have to say, a little bit of a cheat, but it's exactly what they do on TV. So I'm just following on tradition. Do you know how they used to do a Dalek army on the TV show back in the 60s? Okay, if you go back and watch the Dalek Invasion of Earth on Blu-ray, as it's available now, you get to see Doctor Who. It was never meant to be seen on TV. When it was being broadcast on TV in 1965, I think it was, 64, this was, British TVs, and I assume the TVs over here, only had 425 lines on the screen. So it was a very sort of poor image. So they knew they could get away with things. When you watch it on Blu-ray, it's unforgiving. You have the three Daleks, which is all they ever built, standing there, and an army of Daleks behind them. The army of Daleks are cardboard cutouts. They are very obviously cardboard cutouts on modern TV screens. There should be a Blu-ray feature where you have screen in screen, you're like, this is actually how it appeared on telly, so actually it was all right. But yeah, I was looking at it thinking, the sonic screwdriver's got really good now.
So they should have done a Star Wars version where they just, you know, fixed everything.
Yeah.
Except they shouldn't.
Yeah. And also, they say they only had three Daleks. So when you saw Daleks going around a corridor, what would happen is the Dalek would go around the corridor, second one would come, the first one would scurry around behind the camera again. And in fact, there's certain shots where you can see it hitting the camera as it comes by. Camera wobbles.
Well,
and then the set wobbles because it's the set.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting how big the Dalek has become in British culture.
Yeah.
Because like I was telling you last night as well, if you watch a certain episode of Shaun the Sheep, you're going to see a Dalek. Mm. And they stay true to the entire concept of the Dalek with a sheep, an animated clay sheep, in a Dalek costume, not being able to get up the stairs. So, and it's everywhere. It doesn't matter where you look.
Yeah.
There's Daleks.
Well, it was in the early 80s, and I think it's actually World Doctor Who was off the screen, off TV. There was a major political TV drama that ran for several weeks. I mean, it was a big event thing called GBH that was all about political corruption on one of the major cities in Britain. And it was really well done. It dealt with themes of people being compromised by authority, people that, you know, power had corrupted them, and people whose social and personal lives were being destroyed by, you know, these goals they were chasing. And then the third episode of it was staged in a hotel where there was a science fiction convention. And you've got, in the middle of this very, very serious drama, security dragging off a drunk Dalek. And you're thinking, yeah, that's it. Everything in Britain is Daleks. Yeah.
You should write that in your next episode.
I should, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a guy that goes in a Dalek, perfect Dalek, shell at shows in Britain. He's painted his Dalek purple, and he's called Barney the Purple Dalek. And he follows people around the convention hall singing Frank Sinatra standards at them in a Dalek voice.
Oh, we've got to bring that guy here. Could you imagine him walking around?
Yeah.
I was having lunch earlier, and suddenly I hear this. I've got fucking Darth Vader standing behind me. It makes you eat faster. I wouldn't want to have a Dalek singing Frank Sinatra behind me.
It's
no.
Great.
Oh,
Daleks do show tunes, yeah.
Yeah, get scared now. Oh my God. We got more questions, guys?
Oh, come on.
Your favorite companion.
Pardon?
Your favorite companion.
My favorite companion, Sarah Jane Smith. Yeah, she was the companion that, sort of, when I started watching the show in the mid 70s, she was the one that was there, and I thought she was great. And while they were filming, while the show was off the air, I got to do a science fiction show somewhere, and the actress Elizabeth Sladen was at the show, and she came over to chat to me because of drawing the Doctor Who. Because I'd done some Doctor Who stuff then. So even though I've been drawing the series regularly since it came back, off and on I've worked on it either writing or drawing for the comic strip since the late 80s. And she came around and chatted to me. We got on really well. She was lovely. And I was supposed to see her when they were filming one of the last Sarah Jane adventures around the corner from my studio in the Bay. And we couldn't meet up. So we said, oh, never mind. We'll catch up later. And that was a month before she died. And it's like, oh, you know, go and see her again. But yeah, no, she was my favourite. I thought she was brilliant. But I think, based on what I know, what's happening with this season, I think that Clara's becoming brilliant. I think her dialogue is amazing. And the rapport between her and Capaldi's Doctor is fantastic.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I think she's great. But yeah, Sarah Jane, definitely Sarah Jane. More questions?
You're also quiet.
I don't bite unless you want me to.
You will later on.
Is it different that working for American publishers than it is to work for the British? I mean, the whole DC Comics and all that.
Well, what was interesting about the IDW Doctor Who stuff was, well, first of all, the pages were smaller, so that was quite nice, and the stories were longer, because the one of the things that we have with the Doctor Who strip in the Doctor Who magazine is that, well, we've now got 12 pages, but we didn't have that before. So we had to tell stories in very small space. American comic, you've got 20, 22 pages to tell your story. So it can be more expansive. And also the British one is very restrictive about the format. It's almost a European feel to the pages. That's the way they want it to look, and fair enough, it's their strip, you know, I'm just, you know, drawing for them. The American one, I had a bit more freedom to the way I laid pages out, and I could do big headshots, and I could play with that a bit more. The problem we had is that the person at BBC America that looked over the artwork was a bit of a prude. I kept being told off for making Clara's boobs too big. They kept saying there's too much cleavage. Have you seen the show? Excuse me, I'm being very polite here. Yeah, so that was weird. But generally, no, it was good fun. I like working with them, and the crew that were doing it at IDW were great. They were really nice people to work with. And they let me do my stupid Marvel comic style cover that I did for the issue 15, which has actually led, bizarrely enough, to me doing a whole lot of merchandising artwork for Doctor Who in a 70s Marvel style, okay, which is all coming out next month. I've done, they've used my artwork on tippy cups, t-shirts, there's posters you can buy on Amazon at the moment, which are all my artwork, and best of all, now okay, I've worked with some great names. I have gone into schools and I've taught, and I've inspired kids to draw, which is always great. But you know what? I get to do artwork on a Dalek lunchbox, and it doesn't get better than that. More questions? You're all so quiet.
Well, if let's.
You can talk.
I can try. When you are, you've obviously you've got your Dalek comic, the Dalek project with
yeah.
you, and
available on my table.
Yes, go buy it. It's
only
really,
a few copies left.
Is it the one I bought 2 years ago?
I think you had the only good Dalek. I can't remember.
Okay.
Well, you might have that.
But anyways, you're doing this as more of a graphic novel rather
yeah.
than doing a monthly. Would you do you prefer working that way, or would you rather be doing a monthly again, or?
Okay, I'm an artist, and basically that means I'm a flake that barely survives. I need deadlines. I need that focus. So working for an American company doing 20, 22 pages a month, that's great because I know I have to do that, and I will do that. You know, I don't miss deadlines, but I get the work done for deadline. But if I'm not given a deadline, I tend to sort of waffle a bit. So the BBC Doctor graphic novels that I've done, both times they've said to me, well, we want 128 pages and we want it in a year's time. I go, no, don't tell me that. Because in 364 days' time, I will then start it. So I had to insist that we set up a schedule. I said, look, I will say that I will get 20 pages done by this day, 20 pages done by this day, and treat it as a monthly schedule. I had to create that myself, otherwise I wouldn't have done anything.
Do you think that's because it's a TV company who don't understand the production of the comic book or the stages the comics go through?
This is actually the first graphic novels that the BBC's done. And their publishing arm had no concept of it. They used to write us that will turn around, you know, thousands of pages overnight. They didn't understand that we had to have pictures as well. They do take a little while to draw. So by setting that schedule up, I think it benefited everybody. I was still working right until 7 o'clock in the morning on the deadline day, and sleeping for 2 days afterwards. So it's a whole weekend of getting stuff done. But yeah, you need that structure. So it's great doing a big book like that, but you do have to parcel it a bit. So yeah, I did a Christmas Carol for a British publisher a few years back, and I drove them mad because I just sort of picked sequences to draw. And I'd worked out the whole thing, but they were going mad because they go, oh, we've got pages 94 and page 32. They go, yeah, that's what's just finished. But where are the pages in between? Oh, they're coming, don't worry. And they did, they came, it was fine.
You must have got publishers mad, or editors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things. When you get a project that big, you will just sort of drift in and do certain sequences. I mean, quite often what I'll do with a big project is, if there's a certain number of sequences all set around a location, I'll do all those together. So when you come to reading the book, there's a consistency to that, even though you cut in between things. It's like when they film it, like that's how they do when they film it. They will put those scenes together like that. So I feel it's legitimate, but my editors cry.
So let's say, now you were talking a lot about a story that you've just been plotting. If you were to imagine yourself doing another story, and hopefully you will as well. Would you prefer setting it on Earth, or do you want to move out into space and go completely mad?
You can be completely mad on Earth. or is that just me?
Nope.
Oh, good.
He's like this all the time.
There's a reason I'm not back in Britain yet. it depends on the story. I mean, everything, like they say, the futurist story, I just happened to have this idea and then it sort of percolated for ages. I've got ideas for other stories. In fact, I was talking to David Roach that inks me on the Doctor Who magazine, because he wants to write and draw a one-off story. and he's asked me to write it. And he was in the studio the other day chatting. We were sort of pitching ideas backwards and forwards. And he had a couple of ideas I thought were really nice. And then I went, oh, but we could do this. And he went, oh, yeah, if we did that, could we do that? And we could do that. And so these things have come together. And I think you need like a spark. So my editor's saying, write this story. I think what's going to happen is I'm going to write the story that he featuring the elements he wants, but also there's probably things that have been rattling around in my head for a couple of years, which I'll then drop in as well. Because I think, oh, well, that'd be great. And I've got an idea for a big Cyberman story, but I'm probably not going to be able to do that in the comics because the Cybermen, they're very protective about them.
Are they more protective of the Cybermen than the Daleks? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is that the Daleks don't appear in the comic strips because we could only do the Daleks as a graphic novel because it was done for BBC Books. So it was done as an in-house thing. Mm. So, but they don't generally turn it in the comics because there's a whole license thing.
So if you were doing something for IDW, you wouldn't be allowed to do anything with Cybermen at all? They
would have to get special permission to use them.
Okay.
And they'd have to get paid a lot of money. So. Because certain people own the rights, fair enough, because they created them, they own the rights to these characters. So like Terry Nation's estate still owns the rights to the Daleks.
Oh, okay.
So they get paid every year by the BBC. The Daleks will sort of every year because the BBC's paid to have the Daleks.
So there is the creators of the different races and characters and so on, they are actually getting royalties for the characters.
Yeah, they're getting
brilliant.
Which is absolutely fantastic, yeah.
Yeah.
But it also means that there's a certain amount of things you can do. We use the Sontarans in the comic strip because we checked with the BBC and they said, oh, we're not doing any of the Sontarans. And obviously they saw our story and went, oh, we could do something with the Sontarans. Certain things started turning on TV going, I kind of recognise that. but that's fine because we're all part of the same thing. There's a couple of stories in the comics that have turned up on TV. The Shakespeare one was the most obvious, I think. I guess Gareth Roberts, who's written the episode that's on tonight on the BBC, for the comic wrote this story where the Ninth Doctor met Shakespeare, and various things happened in the story. And Russell E. Davies saw the story and went, do you want to adapt that for TV? So he did, so he had the Shakespeare code then, but when he met with David Tennant's Doctor. And then Gareth wrote another story, which is called The Lodger, where David Tennant's Doctor ends up staying in Mickey's apartment for a week because the TARDIS has vanished, the rose in it. And that then got adapted as a TV episode with Matt Smith and James Corden.
Yeah.
So. Again, watching going, I think I may have drawn this.
so basically the comics you've been drawing have been ending up as stories.
But there were certain sequences in the Inside the Dalek episode, which are sort of from the Dalek project, available on my table.
Yeah, I haven't seen most of the new season because I've been busy getting all this ready.
Yeah.
But it seems like everybody on the show is really, really enjoying themselves.
Mm. Yeah, and the office is great because you go into it, and I've done stuff for various bits in the BBC before, and it's all very proper and BBC-like. Not the Doctor Who office. There's posters, there's fan art on the walls, there's comics lying around, there's Doctor Who toys everywhere. It's like a bigger version of my studio. It's great. Okay, I can share this with you, you're nice people. My second visit to the BBC to do storyboarding, I saw like, I'm storyboarding for the BBC, I'm storyboarding for Doctor Who, this is great. And the director had arranged to meet me and she hadn't turned up at the time. And so I was put in a separate room, in one of the reading rooms. And I sit there and I got my cup of tea and I got my artwork laid out and Stephen Moffat walked in with his assistant. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, I think we have this room. And I went, okay, and I'll sort of scrambling all my stuff together. And I thought, it's Stephen Moffat. Oh my God. So I went up to him and said, hi, I'm Mike Collins. I'm storyboarding the episode you've written. He went, oh, I'm Stephen Moffat. I went, I know who you are, sir. Why did I say sir? Why did... He just looked at me like, tit. And when I went in the office a few weeks later, he sort of vaguely made eye contact with me and thought, well, okay. It was nice storyboarding for the BBC. but I had that sort of bizarre fan moment where I just thought, you're Stephen Moffat. I'm terrible. I've been a professional comics and storyboard artist for 30 years now. And I'm still a geek.
Yeah, but that's the best job to have then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be terrible to do this job and hate it. The hours you have to do. I mean, that's the thing as well, you do ridiculous hours, because doing the storyboards, it's like a case of, okay, there's this scene, and this scene, and can you come in on Monday? And then, so you want me to work over the weekend, okay. So and you go, and you work over the weekend, and you take the art with you. So,
yeah.
You go, look at my pretty pictures! which, of course, I can't show anybody until the episodes air, so.
Oh, bad man.
I know.
Yeah, you're talking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got to wait. What about you guys? Is there anything more you'd like to ask, Mike? No? Are you sure? You're like...
Go on.
Oh,
go on.
What's a typical week for you like? I mean, you talk about you're going into the BBC and doing these storyboards. What's a week like for you, and how much time do you actually devote to doing these types of things?
Well, I juggle. I mean, that's the main thing. Not juggle. I mean, I have loads of different jobs. Up until about... 15, 16 years ago, I was exclusive to either Marvel or DC, American comics. And there was a massive implosion, and about a third of the books that companies were putting out went. And unfortunately, all the books I was working on were in that bottom third, they went. And I suddenly realized that I had to do something different. And I thought, well, because I'm actually trained in law and politics rather than art. Nobody can follow the route I took. And I thought, well, do I want to go? Go into lecturing. I thought I could lecture in politics if I wanted to. And I thought, no, I don't want to do that. I can draw, so I'm going to find out places where I can go and draw and pay the mortgage by drawing, which is the crucial thing in all this. And as it happened, an animation company in Cardiff had some spare space, and I started renting from them. And I sort of talked to the guys that ran the company and said, well, look, you know, you've got me in the building. I can draw. And I'm sort of free at the moment. How about I do some storyboards for you? Now, you look at comics and you look at storyboarding, you think, it's just pictures telling stories. I can do that. No, I couldn't. Good Lord. The director I was working for is known in the industry as the one that makes grown men cry. I mean, we're talking the guy that literally tears your art into pieces. I mean, not figurative, literally tears your art. His favourite ploy is if you take artwork to him, he goes, are you happy with this? To which there's no reply. Because if you say yes, he says, you're an idiot. If you say no, he says, why did you bring it to me then? Can't we? But working for Dave was an experience, and I learned probably in about 2 months more than if I'd done 4 years at university studying storyboarding, because Dave went through all my work and tore it up, and anybody I've worked with since has been nowhere near as bad or as mean. It was nasty. It was evil. but after that, I ended up moving studios into another animation company where I do lots of storyboarding, and the art director there is lovely, and he's great. So what I've found is that I can get work in comics, I can get work in storyboarding, and I get work in magazine illustration. So every week is a mixture of all three. So like at the moment, we're just starting a new series for the BBC for preschool kids, which is a lovely little animation show. And I've got my Doctor Who story to write. And I'm doing some illustrations for a project that, if it comes off, will run in 2000 AD, which I'm working with an American writer on. So I've got three different things. So I'm sketching for one, and I've got some more work for this advertising job, doing the 70s style Doctor Who stuff. So I'm constantly doing different things. During the day, I'll switch between two or three different things. Because what you'll do is, for like one storyboarding job, you'll send off the roughs, so while you're waiting for those to come back and be corrected so you can do the finals, you then go and do some illustration work. When you've sent that off, you go and do some more of the comic stuff. And when you send the plot off, you wait for that to come back. So it's constantly spinning plates, that's what it is. It's spinning plates and keeping them all going. And I have grey hair because of it. But no, I think that's after having three daughters. They're all lovely, but oh my God, I've got three daughters. But yeah, so it's mixing the episodes. So no 2 weeks are the same. When I do stuff for the BBC, that's the only time you just work for one person, because the BBC book you by the day, and you will work for them for that day. By the end of that day, you will have produced a certain amount of work. Otherwise, they're not going to book you again. So you know, you're constantly feeding them work, and you know they'll expect a certain number of frames by the end of the day. Because you sort of they'll go and say, well, can you do 20 frames in a day? And I go, of course I can. and then you go, oh my God, I've got to draw 20 frames in a day, and you have to draw the things up and send them off. So yeah, it's a mixture of things. But it keeps me active, and it keeps my mind going, and keeps me in constant state of panic.
Okay, last question of the day.
Last question, do you have time to read any comics, or is there something that you're really fond of at the moment, if you have time, and not the favorite?
My favorite comic at the moment?
Yeah.
Hawkeye. Hawkeye's brilliant.
Yeah.
There was a series that used to be around in the early 80s called American Flag, written and drawn by Howard Chaykin, and it's the closest to a Howard Chaykin comic not written or drawn by Howard Chaykin I've ever seen. It's funny, it's clever. There's one issue just told from the viewpoint of a dog.
Yes,
with dog dialogue. It's
really
amazing. If you've not seen Red Hawkeye, read Hawkeye.
Yeah,
if only the dog issue. I love that. I love anything that's interesting and different. I still read Spider-Man because I think Dan Slott writing Spider-Man is doing the best job that the book's had for years. I still read 2000 AD because I get that free. bits and pieces I read all over the shop, but when I can, I read comics. But I'm generally very busy drawing stuff, so, which is brilliant. I'll never complain about being too busy.
Okay. I'm going to give you time to be more busy.
Hey!
Get even busier.
Doctor Graphic Novels available on my table.
Yes. Mike is going to go back to his table now and draw for another hour.
Yeah.
I actually got one small project for you before you do.
Hey.
And in a few minutes, we're going to have the award ceremony for the cosplay for today. And then once that's done, we're going to have William Simpson here talking about Game of Thrones. And whatever else he's doing these days.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mike.